Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Yeadon, and I'm one of the co-owners and managing directors with Impetus Digital. And for those of you who do not know what Impetus Digital is our company has built some of the best in class asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration tools for life science, pharmaceutical, and medical device companies. And we allow them to do all kinds of creative work with their payers, patients, physicians, allied healthcare providers, in things like advisory boards, steering committees, working groups, investigator meetings, and lately, a lot of internal meetings, brand plan rollouts, doing role playing with sales reps, and on it goes. So it's been really exciting. One of the things that we really believe at Impetus is that everything starts with a thought, and a thought turns into a conversation. And this is really the premise behind these fireside chats, is so that we can actually start to provoke ideas and creativity and imagination. What can healthcare look like in the future? And how can we positively disrupt that? So this is one of the reasons I'm really excited to actually have Anthony DeFazekas, who is actually the head of technology and innovation at Norton Rose Fulbright. So happy to have you here, Anthony.
Pleased to be here, Natalie.
Awesome. So he's actually working for a global legal firm. And I just really want to get into this today because I think there's a lot of really interesting things, not only for big pharmaceutical companies, but also the smaller ecosystem of startups, new small businesses, companies that are pivoting, who really need to hear this information. And so I'm really excited about having that discussion. And Norton Rose Fulbright actually provides big corporations and financial institutions with business law service, but he also services small companies too, companies like Impetus. They have more than 4,000 lawyers based in more than 50 cities across Europe, the US, Canada, Latin America, Asia, Australia, Africa, and the Middle East. I don't think I left any country in the world. So, but anyway, Anthony is recognized as a go-to intellectual IP working with a broad range of IP-rich companies across a number of sectors. So he has a particular focus on fintech and information technology, and also includes artificial intelligence as well as blockchain. He has been named as one of the best lawyers in Canada between 2014 and 2018 in intellectual property law. He has also worked extensively in the innovation sector with many research institutions, large corporate innovators. He works with clusters, startups, and other companies that are scaling their technologies. And he has a proven track record in helping to drive the acceleration and increased valuation of these technology scale-ups. So really, really good to have this in your back pocket. And finally, as the head of technology and innovation at Norton Rose Fulbright Canada, he manages the firm's extensive cross-practice technology and innovation industry group. He leads thought leader initiatives in Canada and is part of the firm's global integrated technology and innovation team. So he is responsible for continuous build out of their scale up programs, including associated legal technologies. So he's the right guy to be asking a lot of these great important questions, as I've mentioned, not only in a big scope way, but also in some of the smaller ways that we're thinking about repivoting or building new ecosystems and businesses. So welcome, Anthony. So happy to have you.
Pleased to be here.
So why don't we actually just get started here? And a lot of times, you know, people, when they think about legal firms, they have their own premonitions or viewpoints of it and, you know, a good thing, bad thing. Why don't you actually paint a picture a little bit about your experience on the legal side of healthcare and technology and what it means to you as being the head of technology and innovation at your firm?
Sure. So one of the things about our firm is that from the very inception, we decided to take an intensely industry-based approach. I can't take credit for that idea. I think a number of the folks involved in management, they spent a lot of time speaking with clients across key industries. And universally, we heard at the time, and we continue to hear this today, a lot of companies, whether they were startups, scale-ups, or large enterprises, Part of what they were saying about lawyers is really appreciate their wonderful technical legal expertise, but there are a lot of nuances when it comes to actually making the advice practical that are industry driven or technology driven. And we're really looking to a law firm that would take, rather than an approach around, you know, this is a securities lawyer, we'll provide you securities advice only, or this is a regulatory lawyer who will answer this particular question. They wanted to really receive integrated advice that was relevant and cognizant of their industry. And so that basic organizational difference really has created a lot of richness in our business. Because we're organized around industry, we have all kinds of different, you know, lawyers, very, very different expertise who are sharing industry knowledge, sharing technical knowledge, and really thinking about what's going on in the industry right now, where legal and ethics is important and can add value to the enterprise. And also, how do we organize that advice across jurisdictions and across different practice groups? So I would say that industry first type approach, and thank you for the introduction, the explanation of my role. My role in Canada is to kind of bring all those different practitioners together around technology and innovation. That's my focus. But talking about healthcare for a moment, which is also one of our key industries, the six of them, part of what we're seeing, of course, is that a lot of the innovation in healthcare is digital healthcare. So not only are we seeing the importance of industries and organizing legal expertise around industries, but we're now seeing a lot of crossover across all of the key industries. So a lot of our focus in healthcare is, you know, taking expertise from the information technology folks and things like artificial intelligence and machine learning and blockchain and the legal and regulatory and intellectual property implications of that, and then translating that into our industry practice around healthcare.
Absolutely. And so on that topic of artificial intelligence, which, as you know, is on the, you know, hearts and minds of everybody, not just in healthcare, but tell us a little bit about how your organization is defining artificial intelligence. And when, you know, companies, specifically biotech and pharma, starts to think about incorporating artificial intelligence into some of their processes, that can actually be done, you know, simply through even their marketing practices or to the application of how they're doing drug discovery. Maybe with, you know, for example, utilizing things like quantum computers or CRISPR technologies or genetic types of technologies. AI can be applied, or these algorithms can be applied in a myriad of ways. So from a legal perspective, what are some of the ethical concerns that companies should be aware of ahead of the game before they start exploring and delving into this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing that I would say is sometimes it's important to step back, at least from a company perspective, because what we're seeing, especially across larger enterprises, is that there is increasing adoption of advanced information technology, including AI, including machine learning. So part of what we're seeing is that a lot of investment is being made and value is being created by having, for example, a more robust approach around analytics. And then there, you know, so there's more advanced analytics in one area. There could be, digitization of processes in another area. And then sometimes there's AI being used extensively across a very specific application, but other times AI is being layered across the entire kind of digital systems, if you will, of the enterprise. And so one of our philosophies is to, you know, take a holistic approach and look at how is the company approaching innovation, including information innovation, and what are the key areas where we need to look at the risks and help mitigate those risks from a legal and ethical point of view. And certainly, as you point out, AI is being used extensively within healthcare companies. And it could be digital healthcare or it could be pharmaceutical. There's extensive adoption of AI. And in terms of the key risks that people should be looking at, there are many of them, of course, but I like categorizing them into three buckets. One, we have the risks that relate to impact on finances of our society, and also loss of work. The second category that I bucket AI-related legal and ethical risks into is really errors in decision-making that are contributed to by AI. And that could be bias, but it could also be breaches of bioethics, for example. It's a lot of times people focus on the bias alone, but there can be other problems in decision-making for sure that impacts not just on the business, but its stakeholders in a negative fashion. And then the third category have to do more with losses and errors and liability caused by the AI decision-making. A classic might be autonomous vehicles crashing, for example. And so those are sort of the three buckets that I like to look at, because otherwise you have your very, very long lists. And I think actually the specific use cases of AI and the risks associated with them and the way to mitigate from a legal and ethical point of view is going to be very specific to the circumstances. So rather than having, you know, a laundry list of risks, I think it's better to have those three categories and then look in a rather granular way around what is the solution and what is the role of AI and who are the different entities that are contributing in a way that's going to impact on that result. It could be the data, it could be the technology, some of it could be internal, some of it could be external. It's very important to map it out and then look at those risks. And I think the key risk that ultimately people are really concerned about right now is those three buckets of risk, but then tied to reputation. So as much as these technologies can help ensure that consumers, as an example, are given better products and services that are more relevant. And to your point, Natalie, even marketing is being used really to really get the message to the right person at the right time, for sure. The problem is, though, that when it is revealed that there is some kind of a breach of some of these risks, for example, the bias example that people really, really like to look to, then not only is that a problem from the business in the sense of a, you know, failure of their processes around building a responsible solution, because a lot of good intentions exist around enterprise. The problem, though, is that the technology is unpredictable, including in its application in specific areas. And as such, if there is a problem, then that impact on the reputation of the company can be quite severe. And so people are really quite concerned about that and wanting to find ways to mitigate those risks.
So I want to linger on some of those because there's a lot of really important concepts there. The first one is on category one, which is really around the impact that AI is and will be in the future on jobs, employment, roboticization, and diminishing the roles. We see this even today with high-resolution imaging and companies in some ways pushing out people like pathologists or ophthalmologists and things like that. And so so there's this progression that's happening, but at the same time there's a concern that we're moving backwards as a society. So I know this is kind of playing in the grounds of, more of a philosophical or ethical discussion, but are these the kinds of conversations that you're having? And as a legal firm, who are you protecting? Are you working both at an employee who's coming back and saying, I got displaced by AI? Or is it the firms coming to you and saying, 500 jobs are going to go underway because we're implementing these new systems? How do we handle this?
Yeah, I mean, as a large business, we have to make choices as to sort of who our constituents are, if you will, and in large part because we need to manage our professional responsibilities in an ethical way ourselves, right? So I think, for example, one of the judgment calls there is that we act for employers and not for employees, because you can't really do both. And so typically the work that we do is with the enterprises, around corporate innovation, around digital transformation, around having ways to manage risk so that you can actually accelerate innovation rather than kind of slow it down and block it, which is really, really critical. And I would say that typically, a lot of the companies that we're working with and part of the industry-based approach's advantage is that we collect so much data and best practices across an entire industry to see, what are the trends? What are people really focused on? And I would say that there are a couple of things to point out. One is, as exciting as artificial intelligence is, and I think we're, past it just being, something that holds promise for the future. There's so many real life applications where, you know, entire business lines are being transformed by artificial intelligence right now. But at the other, on the other side of the coin, I would say that when you look at a lot of the different enterprise type implementations, it's really a lot of times it's enhancing the work that humans are doing right now, making them more efficient, replacing some of the more routine tasks, and then giving those individuals the ability perhaps to focus on higher value work. So we aren't yet at a stage where in a widespread way across the economy, we're seeing replacement of humans and their work. It is still at sort of the enhancement phase. However, nonetheless, there is impact on work for sure. And so a lot of companies, what they're doing is they're analyzing the role that AI is playing in their enterprise across the business lines, the impact that it may have on human resources. And they're also trying to predict for the future, which is hard to do sometimes, but they're trying to look at, okay, what does this mean in terms of displacement of workers and the nature of their work? And how can we as a responsible organization provide training in new areas to kind of uptool in other areas that are higher value that aren't going to be replaced? And I would say for the most part, the companies that we're working with, they are taking that type of responsible approach, even though it's not really being mandated necessarily by legislation, although that seems to be coming in some areas. So I would say that it's that type of holistic approach that the company is looking at, you know, looking at the role of AI in their organization, and also how they can mitigate some of those impacts, including on their employees, because, you know, companies don't want to lose good people. They're, you know, companies are going to need, in fact, more sophistication, more sort of nuanced ability to resolve problems, let's say, within their organizations. And we've seen that across a lot of sectors, not just in relation to AI, but other disruptive technologies, frankly, that the organizations that have, you know, rather than kind of hide the sort of the loss of jobs issue, the ones who have been very open and transparent about it and found solutions to provide enhanced training, they've really become more profitable as organizations. So we predict that the same thing will happen for AI as it did, for example, in digital commerce probably 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. Just a really light note on that one as well, too, as we're still thinking about the employer-employee interaction. We've been seeing and hearing a lot of discussions happening about, you know, post-COVID-19, or we're still in the pandemic and the new working norms of what this looks like. And the somewhat, you know, dispersed, you know, utilization of surveillance technologies that some employers are utilizing to monitor and manage and determine work hours and those sorts of things, sometimes visibly, but oftentimes invisibly. Is there any viewpoints that you have on those sorts of surveillance technologies that may be in use?
That's an interesting question. A little bit, I have not personally been involved in that, right? So I think, you know, somebody in a sort of a labored employment practice, I think would have their finger on their pulse much more on that. I can certainly at least say as an individual that than a spokesperson, certainly that, you know, you're probably right. There probably is greater use of that type of technology. But on the other hand, some of those technologies are not, they're not great at really indicating the productivity of the employee, right? So I think, so part of what I've seen is an industry trend right now throughout the pandemic, for sure, you know, companies have had to pivot in terms of how they're assessing their employees. But just anecdotally, I think, you know, a lot of companies, their observation has been perhaps with, you know, less commuting time, greater flexibility around schedule, you know, certainly if you know, you have to provide proper parameters and feedback. And I think you have to almost be closer to your employees in terms of discussing productivity and expectations and so on. But leading organizations who have that type of flexible culture and people first culture anyways, I think, you know, throughout this sort of, you know, pandemic imposed remote work, provided that they have those approaches and the right technology, I think they've actually experienced increases in productivity across most of their employees. So that's what I've been hearing anecdotally in any case. And, you know, and so as much as perhaps some of those tools are operating in the background, I don't think they're really seen as being very high value in actually managing employees in a responsible and effective manner.
Very interesting. Wanted to move to the second bucket of some of these legal considerations when we're considering high technologies like an AI. You mentioned the idea about intrinsic bias that's built into some of the mathematical algorithms, either through linear logistic regression and, you know, neural networks, whatever it is that people are using. And what's interesting about that is the data is only as good, or the algorithm is only as good as the data that you're putting it in. So here's where the dilemma lies. I think for a lot of companies, especially in the space that we work around, that are involved in clinical trials. So on the one hand, you want to be able to incorporate AI so that, you know, new product discovery is augmented and accelerated. But one of the things that you need is data. Now, one of the issues that we're running into is, data lakes, data oceans, access to the data, people holding onto these data banks, like, for example, in Canada, various provinces holding onto it and not wanting to release it. What do you have to say, especially as we endeavor in Canada, we actually have a digital charter, and I think most Canadian citizens don't even know that exists. There's a whole gap, I think, on education for people to understand what data sharing is, what data ownership is, what is refinement of data, and that whole ethical issue around bias, data, and the unavailability of it, and how do we kind of get out of that loop.
There's a lot in there. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, your point about how AI technology really depends on data is a really critical one. And certainly in terms of some of the negative implications that are possible through the use of AI technology, lack of visibility in terms of how the AI technology was created, and for example, how the algorithms were trained using what data, is absolutely at the heart of trying to assess and then mitigate some of these risks. And so the data dependency of AI technology, I think everybody understands, but what's less understood and where there's less attention spent, in my opinion, is around the provenance of the data that's being used. And really that there's two aspects to that. There's the supplier of the AI technology, perhaps if let's say a company adopting the AI is, you know, acquiring it from an external vendor. And then there's the application of that AI technology, you know, within the organization that was supplied by the external party. And different data might be used, let's say, by the vendor, and then different data might be used by the actual enterprise deploying the AI technology. And sometimes there isn't even a lot of visibility into where that data is coming from, because sources of data tend to be intermingled. And that's at the heart, I think, of a lot of the risks that exist and that need to be mitigated. So typically, when we're working with clients, we really recommend understanding the entire solution and the associated data flows to then dig into, in a very granular way, these issues of data provenance, to identify, for example, where data may have been collected that was, let's say, used to train a key algorithm in a way that breaches privacy laws or breaches ethical considerations around bias. And interestingly and both scarily, like when we get involved in these projects and we have a framework that we've designed really to assess some of these risks quite efficiently, when we reach behind these issues for even very sophisticated organizations, the gaps that we identify that need to be filled by, you know, using different data, let's say, or relying on the AI technology for some applications but not for others, it's quite surprising, you know, even to us. And then the other thing that I would say about that is that sometimes perfection isn't necessarily possible, like in the sense that, you know, you have to sort of mitigate to an acceptable level of risk, but there's something sometimes that you just don't know, right? So I think really the prerogative of organizations is to have robust frameworks to assess these risks and mitigate them to a point of responsibility, corporate social responsibility, I would kind of frame it as. And also know that, you know, it's in some ways you are going to make these risks more manageable by having very strong frameworks as you go to figure out these issues. So I think you mentioned sort of data lakes and data oceans. I mean, part of the issue with data lakes is that masses of data exist without a lot of visibility on where did it come from, how was it collected, under what terms and conditions. So there's within many organizations, understandably, there's this historical looseness around these issues, partially because data may have been accumulated for one purpose, and now the company wants to use it for a very different purpose. And the privacy consents may not have included scope broad enough to cover the laws have changed in between. Frankly, now data is coming from multiple jurisdictions where perhaps the laws said one thing, you know, 2-3 years ago, but now we have this increasingly complex legal and regulatory framework around data where countries that didn't have very strict frameworks all of a sudden have extremely strict ones, right? So, and the data may have been sourced intentionally from some jurisdictions, perhaps, because of sort of more permissive laws, right? So kind of digging behind those issues, going back in history, is extremely challenging and difficult. So the key thing is, including mitigating the past and current risks, is making sure moving forward, you're not going to have these hard to correct problems. So you're going to have a clear sort of decision tree on how you source data, for what types of applications, and all of that, if you make the investment, can actually work very quickly and accelerate again digitization rather than slowing it down completely.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. And today, I think with COVID, we've been accelerated and pushed, if you will, to start thinking about these things with the whole contact tracing app concept, which is we're having to ask these important questions really, really quickly is how are we mining that data? What about privacy? What are you allowed to, you know, exclude yourself versus include? So I think it's a fascinating area that probably requires a whole other discussion. So I do want to ask you in the third bucket that we were talking about, which is really around harm loss, which again is a key area in the legal sphere. So if we take a look at some specific concrete examples, a pathologist who maybe if somebody ended up doing a retrospective study to suddenly start looking at a whole bunch of diagnostic slides and found or find through that retrospective analysis that there were some people who were misdiagnosed who actually had cancer and nothing was done for them. Conversely, as pharmaceutical and bio, you know, medical device and other sorts of diagnostic companies start to get more involved, incorporating AI in a smart way where they become the biomarker companies, will they be held liable for these things in a more of a retrospective manner where things are discovered that nobody understood or knew at the time? So there's this question of losses and harms either retrospectively, but then the question comes down to in the future is how does that also apply in the future? For example, an AI through whatever weird malfunctioning makes a mistake and somebody, you know, either like a robot in a surgery. And so prospectively in that situation, who is accountable for that? Is it the machine? Is it the person who's sitting behind the window? Is it the person who programmed it? So I think there's a retrospective and a prospective question around harm and loss.
Well, wow, that's a lot to unpack in that question. Thanks, Natalie. I'd say a couple of things. So one, and it's important not just from the perspective of technical performance of these solutions, but it's also important from a mitigation of risk, including legal risk and liability point of view. It's very important to design the systems with a human in the loop. And in fact, you know, we're not yet at a stage where, you know, AI is going to operate on its own. It's quite new. Sometimes the results are unpredictable. So there are going to be humans in the loop, but there's a lot of work to be done in figuring out how are those humans brought in the loop? Which humans are they? Are they internal to the organization? Is it going to be made more transparent? So you're opening up details of operation of the AI technology so other experts who are unbiased, let's say, can assess. Do you want to crowdsource that human in the loop aspect? So lots of different stakeholders, including those who are advocating for patients, those who are involved in government have access, you know, to those details as well, so that you can run tests, stress tests, a number of different aspects of the technology across a lot of those, you know, legal and ethical risks that we talked about. So right now, I think we're at a stage where a lot of companies, both those that are deploying AI and those that are supplying AI, they fully realize that human in the loop is a critical component. But we need to develop more robust frameworks in terms of, you know, really figuring out for a particular solution, considering the risk, let's say, for patients, what the audit trail needs to be, and also what's the governance around the involvement through the human in the loop concept. And then the other thing that I would add to that, which is really quite interesting, is increasingly we're seeing technologies where they may incorporate AI technology, but they help automate those aspects. So they help identify when, let's say, given a specific legal and ethical framework that's been set up for an AI solution, because of changes in the application of the technology, you know, the identification of certain errors, for example, changes in the data that's being consumed by the solution, there's new risks, and the technology is not just offside. Maybe we could predict when it's moving offside, right? So what's really quite interesting, I think, in this area is the intermingling of expertise around law and ethics with technology, partially to solve the law, the legal and ethical issues. That's one thing that I'd say about it. And then the other aspect of your question around risk and liability, which I think is really quite interesting, and sometimes I think a lot of the technology experts sometimes miss, as well as some of the companies. So I think there's a bit of a tendency in the industry right now to say, well, AI is new, and there will be specific regulation built for how we mitigate these legal and ethical risks, kind of similar to the GDPR for data. So there's going to be some kind of, you know, pretty comprehensive set of regulations that's going to point us in the right direction. But I don't think that's really going to happen anytime soon. And also, I don't think we really necessarily need new tools. So the law can be very inflexible in some areas, but in other areas, it can be very flexible. So we have basic concepts around negligence and due diligence, and how we allocate responsibilities. And also a lot of these legal principles that we've been using for a very long time, they incorporate, you know, pretty robust approaches around economics to determine, you know, let's say of all the people involved in deploying a solution, who is in the best position actually to mitigate that risk? Because that, if we push the risk in that direction, it'll be better for society. So a lot of those principles are fairly well established, and the legal systems around the world have pretty good track record in reacting to new technologies, applying those principles, and then over time, perhaps defining a fair degree of predictability. So then companies know how the chips are going to fall, perhaps from a risk and liability point of view. So they're incentivized to take appropriate steps to mitigate. And so just to kind of continue on the e-commerce example, we saw that in e-commerce, right? So not that long ago, I suppose, but, you know, and a lot of experts at the time said, you know, digital commerce is so new. How is commercial law going to adjust to it? And for sure, there was a bit of an adjustment period where it may have seemed there was a bit of a vacuum. But the bottom line is, when there are losses and liabilities, those legal principles will be applied, and a pretty good result will come from that. The issue, I guess, for companies is that there is that sort of level of uncertainty currently until those decisions come through, and then you're given the goalposts, essentially, that you have to kind of fit within. But what I would say is that, especially during this era of unpredictability, until those decisions kind of come down, a risk-based approach will help effectively fill that void. So companies, rather than waiting to see what's going to happen in terms of specific judge-made decisions that deal with these issues, take a risk-based approach really to mitigate those risks in advance effectively. Because I think, you know, where you land on a comprehensive sort of holistic analysis of these risks and how to mitigate them across the legal and ethical implications, and where the judges are likely to land, you know, 2-3 years from now, will probably be in the same spot.
Very interesting. And I really want to thank you too to share some of the tools that you have in your legal toolbox of how you handle these things, and some of the growth opportunities, especially as it relates to what you said, which is applying AI in the legal field, which is a whole other discussion as well. So I just kind of want to move to the next step. So now we've talked a little bit about some of these considerations, but as a pharmaceutical, medical device, life science, small, large, what have you, and you're delving into a new area and you want to integrate artificial intelligence into your solution. So what are some of the things that you oftentimes will coach or counsel these companies on around intellectual property, patents, trademark, you know, other things that they need to be considering very early on to protect them?
Yeah, for sure. So I would say that, protecting intellectual property in some of these solutions is very important because the technology is valuable. And effectively, intellectual property in a broad sense, and I'll speak to that in a couple of moments, is critical to protecting that investment and maybe creating some market exclusivity around the specific solution. I would say that there are two critical things to mention as it relates to protecting IP and artificial intelligence. The first is that, you know, there is almost like a bit of a bias against intellectual property protection. Certainly there have been challenges in, for example, patenting information technology in the past, concerns around subject matter and pushback from patent offices around patenting software and so on. But the truth is that there are, you know, literally thousands and thousands and thousands of AI patents out there. So what I worry about is that there are some companies who are really worried about the patentability of AI technology, and they may not be taking steps to protecting their valuable innovation. Meanwhile, other companies are going gangbusters and patenting the entire landscape, and that may set up for a very difficult situation in the sense that certain companies will end up controlling through patents a lot of AI technology, and other innovators may lose access because they may be the subject of infringement lawsuits from the other companies. So we don't want to create, as much as possible, I think it's important to create a level playing field. And I think in order to maintain that level playing field, it's important for all innovators to at least consider whether they have intellectual property that should be protected. The other sort of area, I think, sometimes where there's some misconceptions around protecting intellectual property related to AI is that a lot of times people are focusing only on patents, which I think is a mistake. So I think intellectual property by an innovative company, to your point, whether they're huge or small or somewhere in between, they really should look at intellectual property as a toolkit. So it's a toolkit where there's different areas of protection, could be trade secrets, brands, copyright, frankly, the use of agreements to establish position around intellectual property status and ownership. And there should be a comprehensive toolkit approach to looking at identifying how the value can be protected using IP. And when that happens, then I think the focus actually shifts away from patents a little bit, because it is true that, sometimes, with the over-focus, if you will, around patents and, related to artificial intelligence technology, a lot of resources are put into, let's say, trying to patent an invention. The results in terms of scope of claims that are allowable may not be really what the company wanted. They may over-disclose something that should have been protected as a trade secret by trying to make their patent application very detailed and technical, which is the best practice. So there are mistakes that can be made even by sophisticated organizations. And so stepping back and looking at, what is the innovation? What would be a strategic use of intellectual property for me as a company, given what I want to do with the AI technology? Am I going to commercialize it externally, or is it just something that I want as a market advantage for me as a company? Those are just examples of the issues that one looks at. And then there should be some form of either informal or formal intellectual property strategy to then guide the company. Okay, what is our focus? Where are we going to invest resources? How are we going to mine the IP? What type of IP are we going to build? And more importantly, how am I going to use that IP strategically? So there's real value from that investment. And what does that mean? Not so much for, okay, I have this intellectual property asset or that intellectual property asset, but how do I need to, through education or other mechanisms and investments, really create more of an intellectual property culture within my organization? Again, whether it's big or small, because that's how you're really going to unlock the value. If we build IP just to have IP on a list of assets somewhere, that's not going to create a lot of value. But if we look at enhancing the focus of the organization and the knowledge of the organization around intellectual property protection and also how to use it strategically, that's where we can build elite organizations from an IP point of view.
So brilliant nuggets there and a lot of wisdom to be shared for people to really think about. Wanted to see if you could just speak a little bit to some of the potential issues that people may be concerned about in the IP world. As you were alluding to earlier, there are some people who use that as a strategy. I know some people are calling them patent trolls. And there's some people who just navigate those hundreds and hundreds of patents, and then they just get really, you know, legal savvy, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of pending lawsuits. You can talk about a couple of big firms that maintain their monopolies using that type of methodology. So there could be one strain or viewpoint or perspective that says that's a really good strategy. If you're a certain size company and you have incumbents coming into your space, that actually is a strategy. But how do you also speak to the small startups? And we're seeing some of this going on right now, to be honest, with all the antitrust that's happening with the Big Five and the imminent testimonials or, you know, testifying that they're going to be doing in the U.S. government, that's kind of built on this, if you will. So how do we also allow some of these smaller companies to be able to compete without that kind of overbearing concern about patent trolls and litigation? And, you know, what is the right balance between those strategies?
Yeah, there's there's a lot in there again. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough set of issues for sure. I would definitely reinforce that there are many patent trolls out there, and there are many new ones coming all the time, right? So there's a lot of activity that's there, and it's using up more and more time within businesses in terms of responding to challenges. You know, how do I, you know, mitigate some of those risks, et cetera. I would say that, some of the good news from a small company perspective in all of this is that typically the patent trolls are going to target larger entities, right? So a lot of the patent trolls are being set up with a strategy of, you know, they're building a portfolio through acquisitions of patents and then creating other patents to fill the gaps and so on. That's sort of a typical sort of patent troll strategy. And then they're very opportunistic by looking at industry where, the risk associated with the infringement of those patents is high because, you know, the economic value of the infringement is also high. So by nature, a lot of those companies, they really have their sights set on larger companies. Patent litigation is very expensive for everyone, for large companies, small companies, and patent trolls too. So they usually take a very nuanced, tiered approach to whom they're going to target in what order. And they may get to small companies later, but by the time they do, there's probably going to be a well-established price for access to a license that's designed really to make it more worthwhile for the company to take a license than even hire a lawyer, frankly, at that stage. So the activity is more focused initially on the large companies, high risk, where the patent troll wants to make a name for themselves and and create some momentum for their licensing programs. That's kind of roughly, it can be much more nuanced than that, but that's kind of the strategy effectively that underpins these trolls. So from a small company point of view, you know, they're typically not going to be initially a target. But what I think is really important, and you know, this is one of the areas where we really focus with the scale-ups, is that as the startup maybe starts scaling where they've, you know, perhaps they've raised substantial money or their revenue is growing quickly, they do get on the radar, right? So then the question I think for the company is in this sort of scaling up also of their processes around IP, how should they begin looking at freedom to operate? Small companies typically tend to focus on protecting the IP that it makes sense for them to protect, perhaps patenting some of these innovations. And they're less focused on what third parties may have patents where their technology or product may infringe that patent, because that's a very expensive analysis to go into. But as the company scales, they have to right size what mitigation of some of those third party intellectual property infringement risks mean for them. And so usually what that means in terms of the work that we do with scale-ups is layering on some analysis around looking at the patent landscape, the patent trolls and others as well, Natalie, just to kind of clarify, because the risk, it comes from both of those areas. And then look at, well, what can we do to mitigate some of these risks? Sometimes you can identify areas of high risk. So there's a really broad patent exactly in their space. Maybe for the next version of the product, you can make some tweaks to reduce that risk. Maybe rather than waiting for the lawsuit, you almost have up your sleeve some patents that question the validity, let's say, of a particular patent that might be, you know, asserted against you. So as you scale, you also want to scale your investment in and knowledge and preparation for those types of enforcement actions. And then the flip side of it, I would also say, is that, you know, the best defense sometimes is an offense, right? So you know, there's lots of nuanced strategies that go into preparation for these types of things. But another reason why a company might want to patent their technology is that, you know, there could be third-party patents covering aspects of their technology. But when somebody comes out of the woodwork and, let's say, asserts a patent against a business, and their answer is, well, you know, we also have a patent for this product. And so if you want to argue about where your patents end and ours begin, let's do it. And usually in those circumstances, the company asserting the patent may just sort of fold away, because that's very costly, risky to them, especially when maybe they're not a patent troll, but they're a commercial company. So the response might be, well, you know, if you sue us, we'll also sue you for infringement. Because there can be that overlap, if you will, of patents. So one patent may cover one particular aspect of a product, another patent may cover another aspect of the product. And in fact, neither company really may have freedom to operate without access to the other party's patents. So there's that defensive use of patent strategy as well that comes into play.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, it is an entire world of strategies. It's like a chess game. It's really, really interesting.
That's why it's so fun.
Yeah. So thinking about this, you know, your patent ends here, mine starts here, you know, part of the whole process of scaling up or building our companies is really about partnerships and, you know, getting together with other organizations or sharing ideas, sharing data, publishing data, right? So now we start getting into murky waters. What kinds of advice would you give to companies of all sorts of sizes around sharing and partnerships?
Yeah, great question. So I would advise everyone to make sure that they are collaboration ready from every viewpoint possible. And you know, your question kind of behind it is that there's more and more collaborative development. I mean, so many studies have shown that collaborative development is more efficient, yields better technology. There are all these advantages, but the difficulties lie in the fact that because you're trying to work with someone else, there's inherently going to be wrinkles around ownership of technology, ownership of data that you need to resolve. And if you were working completely internally, as long as you have strong employment agreements with your employees and so on around ownership and of data, technology, intellectual property, you know, you're not exposed to those risks. So many companies are opening up, you know, large ones, small ones, in between ones. And part of certainly what we've seen through COVID is there's been intensification of collaborative development across a number of areas. It's been interesting to watch, and we've been involved with a lot of that. It's been fun to manage. But ultimately, you know, all of these organizations, where they're working with external parties, it could be a competitor, it could be a, you know, friendly large company, it could be a scale-up who's actually has a real track record in managing collaborations, or it could be a startup who's very new to it. And part of what we see across all these different types of organizations, you know, there are certain companies that have tremendous expertise in, for example, doing due diligence on their collaborators, managing the process, all of the legal and IP implications, et cetera, from end to end, you know, really kind of switching from this, it's this type of collaboration, this is the risk profile now, now it's changing because of these, let's say, business or technical factors. So they automatically kind of change their game plan, if you will. That type of level of sophistication is actually quite rare out there, just because, you know, collaboration is new to some organizations, and it often is moving into different and new areas technically for the team anyway, so it's very difficult to keep up. So everybody, I think, needs to kind of step back and think, okay, what types of collaborations are we doing, and are we really ready for it? Do we have the right tools, the right templates, the right kind of risk lens, sets of decision trees, do and don't type items that we kind of pervade through the organization, give it to the right people with training so that we're all kind of upskilling in this area. So having all of those processes and tools and resources are important. And sometimes we find that there's gaps that can be filled. The other area I'd say is around intellectual property for sure. I mean, there are a number of best practices that come to mind, and I'm just going to mention one or two. One is a lot of times companies will collaborate with one or more external parties. And sometimes the reason why the parties have come together is because there's complementary background intellectual property, technology, data. And it's really important to really have clarity around what your contribution is, like what you're bringing to the table, what you own that predated. Because then when people start bringing their contributions together and they start intermingling them through the collaboration, things can get very messy from an ownership point of view. And a lot of the friction, the concern in doing collaborations future, because look what happened in that particular collaboration, and even lawsuits and arbitrations come from difficulties in managing who owns what, essentially, you know. And one key best practice for sure is at least make it very clear what you come to the party with. And a lot of companies actually don't do that. So one mechanism might be to shore up some of your patent filings related to what you are contributing and the state of the art of your background IP. That's one best practice. And then another key thing is to have a really robust agreement covering the collaboration. A lot of times what we see as a challenge is that a lot of the parties are not, they don't put a strong agreement in place because they don't know what the collaboration is going to be about yet. The idea is to bring people together and figure that out. But with the proper sort of discipline and expertise, you can actually map out how it's likely to work out and build in sufficient flexibility into your agreement so that if certain circumstances change, you can switch gears. So those two things of, you know, doing your kind of prep work around IP and then having a strong but flexible and practical agreement, despite the uncertainty and lack of predictability, are two key things that come to mind.
Yeah. So really good nuggets there. And I think incorporated all of that, there's a certain level of trustability that you almost just have to trust the system in some ways, or trust the agreement with some of its built-in reflexivity as well. Another exciting area outside of AI, and just in the last few minutes here, is your perspective on blockchain. Blockchain, as you and I both know, could potentially really disrupt not only healthcare, but so many other industries, banking, any, you know, sort of distributed autonomous organizations, everything from replacing, you know, political parties to, you know, self-manufacturing of your own fleet car services. It's just, the possibilities are endless. So any sort of thoughts or closing thoughts on what you have been experiencing around discussions of companies delving into the blockchain space?
Sure. I would echo your optimism around what the technology can do, including in healthcare. And certainly we've had the privilege of being involved with many exciting enterprise blockchain projects, including in healthcare. And so, I'm a big believer in the promise of what the technology can deliver, and not just in sort of a narrow blockchain community way, but for the entire society and enterprises and so on. One of the things, though, that certainly I've observed is that, especially when we're looking at enterprise blockchain implementations, because those are the ones that are higher risk in the sense that they're, it's the reputation of the company. If it's being deployed, commercially, there's probably lots of consumers and B2B activity on these types of platforms. And what I'm certainly seeing is that a lot of times the relevant details around what is this blockchain solution, how is it actually architected, what are the building components, what are the related technologies, including AI, that are being layered on? There's not sufficient visibility around what is the solution really for then the folks who are involved, let's say, in the enterprise from a risk point of view, to really assess, okay, where are some areas of concerns that perhaps we need to mitigate? So a lot of times I think people talk about blockchain generally, but in fact, blockchain, depending on how it's implemented, can mean many, many different things in terms of how you actually operationalize that trust and what the implications of that trust may be. And purely from a legal lens, the other part that I think is really important is that when you look at the specific blockchain implementation and the related infrastructure, there are real questions around regulatory implications, cybersecurity, because as secure as blockchain is, it may not necessarily be secure enough in certain areas. And then I also see a lot of what I would call very generally procurement risk. So almost similar to AI, what I see with blockchain is there are often many different vendors involved. There's certain blockchain technologies and platforms, and then there are, service providers that are going to help design the overall system to include those components. And then there's a sort of the related technology such as AI that I mentioned earlier, and who's responsible for what, and where can things go wrong, and who is left holding the bag in those circumstances. There's a lot of almost like ambiguity in the agreements, right? And so, again, I guess we come back to sort of the risk-based approach. I think it's important to sort of, step back and look at all those things and then understand how best to mitigate those risks, including around open source. I mean, blockchain, it's not unique to blockchain, but a lot of the technologies that are being used, there are, open source licenses that are applicable. I personally feel open source licenses can be navigated, but you have to really know what you're dealing with and understand what the terms actually say and what that means for obligations to distribute code and to provide, access to certain technology, intellectual property that may be a derivative of the open source technology, et cetera, and how that kind of maps across the solution and the commercial interests of the various parties. So those are some of the things that I think are important to highlight. But at the end of the day, All of this is doable in the sense that the risk can be mitigated in an acceptable way as long as you're investing the resources to do so.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, as you can see, any and all of these topics, we could literally go down a rabbit hole with. There's so much there, and it's so current, and it's so new and novel and kind of scary for a lot of people, but it really is intriguing. And one of the things I just wanted to leave on the blockchain is there can be a whole discussion on the demonetization or the democratization of health data, where the patients suddenly in the blockchain system can monetize their data. Whoever ends up tapping into it through the blockchain, if it's a researcher or a clinician or somebody else, they get paid. And that could potentially be the framework for the new universal basic income. So I think it'd be very interesting to see what could happen there. I'm certainly aware that you're probably delving into all kinds of new systems in the future, and would love to hear from you again about what you're working on with digital health systems and machine learning and quantum computing. But I think just in the interest of time, we'll probably want to end it there. But fascinating topic. You're obviously an incredible thought leader in this space, Anthony, and it has been an absolute pleasure. For those of you who could not attend, we are leaving a recording of this so that you'll be able to access this. Please be on the lookout for our links to our Twitter, podcast, YouTube channel, and our LinkedIn profile. We'll also be leaving that for Anthony and the website to his company if anybody is intrigued enough to want to talk about some of the stuff that you're working on. So again, Impetus Digital is here to be the bridge for some of these conversations, some of these big, hairy, audacious, provocative topics that are going to truly inspire and positively disrupt healthcare. And that really is the promise behind the Impetus Digital platform, is so that we can actually asynchronously and synchronously create collaboration and discussions. So thank you very much, Anthony, for a fantastic conversation. Thank you to everybody who has also been able to attend today. And thank you so much, Anthony, wishing you a wonderful day.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for the great questions.
Excellent. We'll talk to you soon.